everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, Abuse. And, of course, joined by my two partners in crime, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the L.A. field office of HHS-OIG, and now a manager on our SIU team, and Matt Kachansky, the retired special agent in charge from the OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and my counterpart as the senior director of payment integrity. So today we want to talk about, there was a report that was put out by the OIG last week. It was released on September 3rd, so that would have been last week. And it talked about Medicaid plans and MCOs and SIUs and the referrals. And it talked about sort of the lack of money that was being recovered. It talked about the fact that there weren't referrals coming out, a whole host of things. And it's been the buzz on LinkedIn, and everybody is opining about it. And I love when people are opining, and I love even more when the people who don't have intrinsic experience in the space throw out all kinds of vernacular that seems to work well for the conversation. So it got us all looking at this report, and it got us all thinking about this report, and it got us all kind of being interested in this report. So this is online, and you can take a look. Some Medicaid managed care plans made few or no referrals, and obviously there were four kind of highlights. If you've ever read any of the OIG reports, so these reports, for those of you that aren't inherently conversant, there are multiple divisions within the OIG. Matt, Wade, and I worked at the Office of Investigations. We were the badge and guns. There's the Office of Evaluation and Inspection, or OE&I, Office of Audit Services, OAS. I actually do a presentation that I am happy to do for organizations that want it about OIG operations, and I talk all about the different operating divisions. And so if you are interested in having me present for your organization, just send us an email at hello@advisehealth.com, and we can set you up with doing that. I'll do it remotely. We do it off hours. It's a great way for us to be able to educate people on OIG. I digress. So I go back, and we found that, you know, one of the things that kind of stood out, and Wade, this is where I want to start, because we talk a lot about this. You know, Wade, Matt, and I all spent a very large portion of our time at the OIG doing training and education in one way or another. Matt did a lot of training and education for new agents during the new agent training and special agent basic training on Medicare-related fraud issues. Wade was an enforcement and operations-related instructor, firearms and the like. I was defensive tactics, control tactics instructor. And then the three of us collectively also did a lot of training with special agent basic training on program-related stuff. And here at Advise, we do a lot of education and training for SIUs that are both clients that exist on our SIU space and just kind of one-offs. And so obviously when we saw this, plans that receive training from the state or the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, or MFUCU, on fraud referral process made more referrals. However, only half of plans reported they received such training. And my head blew off. I could not believe it. I was so taken aback at this, because we speak a lot about the importance of training. And the fact that only half of the plans out there reported receiving training, but that empirically, based upon this study, plans that received training made more referrals. And so, Wade, we talk about this all the time. And again, it kind of gets back to this connection of training and a law enforcement liaison. And nobody is saying that you necessarily need to have a dedicated full-time person that's a law enforcement liaison. Some plans do that. Larger plans who tend to get maybe more subpoenas, more RFIs coming in, requests for information, requests for assistance, may need some internal support to manage and operate all of that. We know of some plans that actually have some of those full-time people, but smaller plans don't inherently need to have that. But at the end of the day, Wade, this goes right to the heart of it. If you have somebody who is regularly interacting with the state or with the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit or with the OIG, you get to understand a little bit about what the flavor of the day is, and you can help to facilitate regular training, which is communication and information sharing. And, you know, that was, I know when you were over in LA, that was a big part of what you did, was liaison work. You know, those that can do cases, those that can't liaison. So it kind of, it is what it is. But I was really taken aback. And I know, you know, when we talked about this, that was the first thing that you brought up, was kind of like a, what?
Yeah. And The metrics that they were talking about too, I think were kind of interesting before I jump into the liaison part, but they said that as far as received training versus did not receive training, there were 2.1 referrals per 10,000 members, as opposed to 1.31 per 10,000 members. So it's somewhat significant, but it's not a huge difference. It's not like 10 times more because of the training. So I think the key there is the training is obviously very important, but along with the training, I think that liaison part, or at least the direct contact, is as important, if not more important, than having, you know, a yearly training session, because that person or people, if it's a dedicated liaison person or contact that has law enforcement experience, whatever, it's a direct communication. It's like a bridge from the SIU to law enforcement, whether it be the MFUKU or the OIG or whoever, that just has some more of that experience that maybe the rest of the team members on the SIU doesn't. And that's just a matter of knowing what they're looking for. You know, looking at the increase in the referral quality based on the types of cases they're looking for, you know, how to package them, maybe the thresholds that if you don't have that one person that has the bridge across to the law enforcement, you don't know these things. You don't know what the thresholds is. You might be sending referrals for, you know, $20,000, and they won't look at it if it's less than $100,000. So all those things really help to kind of package a more a referral that's more likely to get attention and get worked. Right. The other issue that we see a lot of times, and I was guilty of this on the other end of it when I was receiving referrals from different other agencies, whether it be SIUs or even from the MFUKU. A lot of times when the OIG gets a referral, they take it and they run with it and they work with it, and it's hands off. If you refer it to us, you have to stop working it because we're working it. And there's really not a lot of feedback that goes back. So it, like I say, we were guilty of doing that as well. But that's one of the detriments, I think, where the SIUs are less likely to want to turn it over, because they're done working it. They're not going to get any type of ROI on it at this point. And lot of times they won't hear back for years on it because we're working it.
And not to interrupt you, but you know, one of the issues that always seems to come up is this premise of the term credible allegation of fraud. You see it across the board in the CMS space. It's credible allegation of fraud is going to be the thing that could get you suspended from payment from the Medicare program. It's also the thing that's going to lead to referrals. You know, here we do a lot of expert work for law firms where we're asked to make an opinion about certain things. And, you know, when we write these reports, we don't talk about credible allegations of fraud, or we don't actually come out and say fraud, waste, abuse. Because that's, you know, making that determination is kind of a legal decision, but we'll say this has indicia of fraud, waste, abuse. But, you know, at the end of the day, part of the discussion of a credible allegation of fraud is you have to talk to the people that ultimately are making that final determination, right? Some are obvious, some may be more nuanced, but another piece of that puzzle then becomes when you're having these regular conversations. And I think one of the things that I would intimate from reading this report on a lack of referrals is because when cases get referred, they take time. You could have a case that gets referred over and it could take 2 years, 3 years, 4 years to investigate. And at the end of the day, someone might make a determination that that case is not really something that they want to continue to pursue. And then they turn it back over to the SIU. And now the problem is that you have a statute of limitations issue, you have a recovery issue, maybe the provider is no longer billing, there's a whole bunch of other things. And so to an extent, you know, I think there's a legitimate argument to be made that SIUs don't want to make referrals to law enforcement if they can handle it as an administrative matter, because that's going to affect their ROI. And so that's why having those conversations on a regular basis, because we all know that as prosecutors rotate in and out of offices, whether it be MFUKUs or whether it be U.S. Attorney's Office or whatever, priorities change. Mental capacity to deal with a certain kind of case changes. And so you may be working on something and it may be something that looks like a great case that's a referral. And, you know, lo and behold, you refer it and 3 months later it gets turned back and they weren't interested in it. So that communication is kind of an important piece, which, Matt, this gets kind of to the next piece, which is that you know, one of the other things that they highlighted, and let me bring this back up and share this, is this premise that plans with fraud referral staff dedicated solely to that Medicaid plan had more provider referrals than plans working across. However, 78% of plans reported their referral staff shared program integrity responsibilities. And that really, what that really means is, if you are at a plan that has a Medicaid line of business, maybe a Medicare Advantage and a commercial, what we see sometimes is that, particularly with a larger payer, they have a dedicated team that's on the Medicaid side, and then they have another team that's on the commercial or the Medicare Advantage side. But it, ultimately, it comes down to that when you have people that are in a very specific niche, they become very conversant with that payer, with that state policy and all of that. And so it was an interesting premise to see that kind of twofold, which was that dedicated staff will get you more referrals. But the other piece of this, and share the screen one more time, is that 10% of plans reported that they didn't make any referrals of potential fraud, waste, abuse in 2022. Now, one of the things that kind of couples with this is what we don't know off of this, and we'd have to take a little bit of a deeper dive, is how many people were being covered by that plan. Did some of these plans just not have an SIU at all, and so therefore they did nothing? But the kind of, it begs the question of, if they made no referrals and they did have an SIU, what are they doing? Is there a data issue? And that all gets into kind of, and I know I'm throwing a lot into this, but it comes down to, like, you know, ROI and that data, and, you know, are your dedicated staff doing the things that they should be doing to get where you want to be?
Yeah, it comes down to resources and priorities and knowing what the process is. Like the OIG report pointed out, some of them didn't know what the process was because they weren't trained on it. Having someone dedicated as a law enforcement liaison or a Medicaid referral SME can add to the ROI of an SIU, because they're not, to be able to make good referrals, not only do they have to be speaking with the MFUCU or the Attorney General's office or whoever, they need to be working with the SIU on all the cases that they're looking at, so that they can then separate those cases into, these should be worked for toward a referral, these should be worked toward recovery, so that the resources of the SIU can then be made more efficient in getting to the correct resolution of those cases. So having someone do that, while it's an extra resource, can add to the ROI, not, and as well as add to the numbers of good referrals. So having a resource like that is important. And I know some of them can't afford to do that. One of the things I've seen lately in some of our clients is the states, the three of the states that our clients work with, New York, Ohio, and Nebraska, every case that we work as their SIU gets referred to the state, no matter whether we think it's worthwhile or not. We can't take action, and the plan cannot take action until the state has looked at it and then passed it back to us. Now, that works in terms of getting the numbers of referrals up, because it's every one of them. But I'd have to say 90% of them shouldn't have gone there. So we're writing up these referrals because we have to, when I know it's, you know, it's an overpayment issue. And I know it's going to come back. Sometimes it'll come back 6 months later, a year later. Wade just had one that was with the state for 2 years, and we got it back last month with claims from like 2018 and 2019 that we have to collect. Having right. someone on up front being able to separate the wheat from the chaff can really add to the efficiencies of the SIU and bring back ROI. Because this right. case that I'm talking about, it's a large case. Our chances of getting a recovery now, very slim. Had we done it at the beginning, probably much better.
And that's amazing. Like, you know, and it, not surprising. So amazing and surprising are two different things. The fact that you have claims from 2018, 2019, the question now becomes, we're coming up onto the, you know, last portion of 2025. So we're talking about claims that are 6-7 years old in some cases. you know, number one, there's a presumption, is the provider still above ground, right? Is the provider still alive? Is the provider still working? Is the provider still billing the plan? And the other kicker of it is that if the provider wishes to appeal any overpayment, does the provider even have the records still to argue? Because at the end of the day, if the records are now more than, say, six, depending upon each state, some states have a 6-year requirement for record retention. Some may have 7 years for record retention. So the question becomes, if the provider wishes to dispute, they're going to, in some cases, they might have to rely solely upon the records that were produced whenever they were produced to come up with the overpayment. So there's a, it's a challenge. And I think the biggest challenge that you know, that we see in the SIU space is exactly this. We saw it incessantly with the UPICs when we were all at the OIG. And Matt, you ran the UPIC. You were the guy that had to deal ultimately with whatever it was. And the biggest issue will always be when a referral comes into OIG that may look good on its face, and then an OIG agent works on it for a year, and then, you know, the case could be 2 or 3 years old at that point, and then lo and behold, you work on it for a year. U.S. Attorney's gets in office, gets involved. They work on it for a little bit, and then it's decided that it's not, the juice isn't worth the squeeze, and it gets returned. And you know what we would typically do is send it back to the UPIC and say, this case is being declined. Please take any action you deem necessary, which was really our way of going, you're going to probably do nothing with it because it's too late, but there's nothing that, you know, whatever. If the case was declined and nobody else wants it, like, what are you going to do? And then the problem becomes that the UPICs then get annoyed at the OIG, creates an acrimonious relationship, because then the UPIC has to go back to CMS and say, hey, what do you want us to do with this case? And then, you know, it's this mouse on a wheel. So it was really no different when you're talking about the UPICs and the government space to the SIU space. It's kind of this thing. And at the end of the day, the argument then becomes, why bother making a referral to law enforcement unless it is the most egregious? Well, then it kind of gets back to the conversation we just had with Wade, which is, how do you know what the most egregious is until the Mufuku tells you what they think is the most egregious? So it becomes this mouse on a wheel. And so the take home, I think, for the three of us when we look at this study is training will always be that foundation. And the fact that there were so many plans around the country that didn't get any training, you have to kind of, I guess, you know, not intimating, but whose responsibility is it to sort of work with getting that training? Is it the plan's responsibility to go out to the state or the Mufuku, or is it the state or the Mufuku's responsibility to provide that training back to the plans? And then in that same vein, when you've got states that have multiple Medicaid payers in their state, 3 or 4 MCOs, as they may call them, or more, the question then becomes, should the state be facilitating information sharing meetings? You know, whether that be virtual, whether it be live, whether, you know, whatever it may be. And as part of that information sharing is their training on what is it, what's the flavor of the day, right? We just saw a study put out, OIG just put out a study on skin substitutes. I saw that study and I was like, what? We've been talking about skin substitutes. We've podcasted about it at least a couple of times. I know I've had conversations with it with people. I've done other podcasts where we've talked about it. We've blogged about it. We have cases about it. And it's kind of like, hello, Captain Obvious. Thanks for telling us that skin substitutes are a problem. Instead of identifying that it's a problem, let's figure out a way to fix the problem. And you do that through information sharing and referrals and all of that. So it's kind of a moving ball. Nothing in this report, I think, was really surprising to any of us. You know, we kind of see it from the inside. But, you know, I think from our SIU side, we understand the frustration on these referrals, the lack of referrals, all of that. You know, we have one payer client that we run their Medicaid SIU for. And one of the reasons that we're doing it is because the previous vendor, over however many years they were the vendor, made 2 referrals. We're doing something like, you know, we're doing like 5 cases a month or something like that. They were doing, you know, 2. They did like 2 cases in like 3 years. So I think, you know, the question I have about all of these plans that didn't make any referrals, I think there are a lot of questions that that brings up, which is, do they even have an SIU? Do they even, are they using any sort of a data platform? Are they doing any data analysis? Are they all being reactive? You know, we have a client that we're getting ready to onboard. Their SIU is comprised of basically one investigator, and the one investigator is spending their entire time on reactive work, hotline complaints and things of that sort. They never get to do anything other than kind of lead vetting and dealing with hotline complaints. And so, and most of those, as we know, because we see these a lot of these complaints that come in aren't even FWA related. You know, there's some other issue in which people are complaining to the hotline and then people don't know what to do with it from within. So I would say even from a training perspective, it even goes into whoever the person is that's taking the hotline complaint or the person that's on the customer service line, getting that to the right place and being able to vet some of these things early on. So like I said, I don't think that this report was an eye opener for any of us. It kind of solidified a lot of things that we've been talking about, which is training and education and having investigators that are properly vetted on how to understanding on what is a credible allegation of fraud per that MFUGA or that state. And, you know, some of these other pieces of the puzzle. So we'll see, you know, typically what happens with these is OE and I will do a follow-up study. And they'll see if any of the changes were made. There's always going to be a recommendation area. OE and I will always come out with a recommendation, and it'll be up to everybody to say whether or not they concur or dissent. And if they dissent with the recommendations, why they dissent with the recommendations. A lot of that's going to go back to CMS and kind of how CMS interacts from that Medicaid perspective, as ultimately the, you know, typically the 50% payer. A lot of people, I think, sometimes forget that Medicaid is 50% federal monies as well. So it's going to be interesting to see what the follow-up, you know, on this is. So if you have not read this study and you are on the Medicaid SIU side, it is worth taking a read and just kind of seeing where OIG was going on this study and kind of, you know, how is it, how does your plan work? And if you're in that leadership role, are you making referrals? How are they looking? And, you know, where do you see the referral process going for your particular plan in light of what the study has shown? So it's interesting. I think the other piece of this was that they talked about that some plans only made, you know, two referrals for every 10,000 lives or something like that. And, you know, if you have a lot of lives, you know, you could be looking at having to make an excess of 200 or 300 referrals in a year. So those metrics aren't necessarily accurate. I think it was just to set a benchmarking that, you know, some plans had at least 10,000 lives and it made only two referrals. So you have to kind of just read the study for what it is. Don't read too much into it and see how that benchmarks to your stuff. But these studies come out all the time. And so none of it is, if you're in the space, I don't think any of us are surprised by it. We just kind of read it, take it with a grain of salt and hope that some of the payer community looks at that and says, how can we become more operationally efficient? So good stuff as always, guys. We got lots, there's always lots to talk about. So, you know, we'll keep up the conversation. And again, for all of you, when you send us this stuff, we look at it, we create a podcast about it. So we'll continue doing that. And again, we've got at the end of the month, we've got a part two LinkedIn Live, myself, Dan Olson. We're going to be doing the part two on data analytics. We're really going to be talking about the life cycle of a claim. We're going to be talking about why it's important to understand the life cycle of a claim from a data perspective. And then we're going to talk about data modeling and how data modeling is an important piece of the metric to help to tamp down some of the noise on what could potentially be some false positives and things of that sort. So thanks again, as always, for tuning in. And again, you can get our newsletter to you every Friday right to your inbox, where you'll get the copies of both our blogs and as well as getting a link to the OIG Roundtable. And if you do not get our newsletter, it'll be up on LinkedIn and it's always up on Spotify and on our YouTube channel. So good seeing you guys. And as always, we'll catch everybody on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody. Thanks again.
Thank you.